You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things.
Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and I am so delighted to be speaking with Krista Bilton. Did I say that right? Krista Bilton, who is the author of this book, Normal Family on Truth, Love, and How I Met My 35 Siblings. 35 siblings. So right off the bat, and I would just say, you know, truth in advertising and all that. I know Krista. Well, it's interesting. We know each other for a very long time, and in some ways, hardly at all, because I know her because she went to a school I was at, and that she was at for 1 year, her senior year, and a piece of that in the book. And I'm so delighted because I was also and am also very fond of Krista. So what a lovely thing for me to be in touch with you again after all these years, and especially after you're such an accomplished writer. I want to tell you how much I just told you a moment ago, but I want to tell you now and preserve it in the posterity of Zoom recording that, I loved reading your book. It really did. It took me to so many different places that I didn't expect to be taken. So hopefully we'll talk about that. And
I guess the sort of tagline that they put in the subheading, although the book is about so much more than that, but
it really is.
Is that I found out in my mid-20s that the man I had known as my dad, after I was born, secretly became one of the most prolific sperm donors at the California Cryobank Bank, and that I had anywhere between several dozen and possibly hundreds of half siblings growing up all over the US. So that's sort of the jumping off point. And the book opens with me sort of, after 10 years from learning about that and not wanting anything to do with these siblings, 10 years later to inviting a bunch of them that I had never met to my home. And so that's sort of where the book opens. And then I take you back to how we got there. But really, it's the story of me growing up with my incredibly unconventional mom and dad in the 80s, 90s, Los Angeles.
When did you know that you were a product of a sperm donor and that your mom and dad didn't consummate?
My mom found my dad in a hair salon and thought he was very handsome. My lesbian mom found my father in a hair salon and thought he was very handsome and asked him if he would father her a child for a financial transaction.
And when did you first know that piece? Was that the 10 years before? Was that then?
Yeah. I had always been told growing up that, you know, because he was a quirky, eccentric guy who was in my life, and I tell that story. But I just knew him as dad, and I had sort of been loosely told that they were best friends who had had a kid together. So it was only upon discovering his secret sperm donor life, which occurred after I was born. So I was the first kid. It was only upon realizing that a bunch of questions started to sizzle up in my consciousness. And I started realizing that a lot of the story wasn't true that I had been told.
Right. And when did you know that your mom was a lesbian?
I knew that always.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I knew that always.
That wasn't the same. Yes.
Yeah, so you had her many girlfriends.
Yeah. I didn't know that. So
you didn't?
I certainly didn't know that when I first met your mom.
I mean, it is a story. Yeah. So for context for listeners, I I feel such a so much deep appreciation for David because we went through a very hard financial time that crystallized around sort of both hard financial time and my mom's drug addiction. And we couldn't get through school. And David took us in at New Roads when he was the principal. So that was a very kind thing. And it's really surreal to be here so many years later talking about this book.
Indeed. And I always knew you were a great writer just from that year. And but you really are a great writer, so thank you. I went through so many things in the reading of this book, and this ultimately is a question about you, about what you went through in the writing of this. For much of this book, I hated your mom, mm-hmm. and totally hated your dad, and I was periodically pissed off at you. Well, we just spoke about that, but and then had so much compassion for, ultimately came to, it's like you push the compassion button, and not just for me, but for your mom, for your sister, for you, for your dad, and for family, and for all of those siblings. And and in some ways, I ended up reading it both as a story about you and a story about your family and a story about your mom. Me too. I'm tearing up too.
It's
not supposed to happen. And
I never do this in podcasts.
Well, there you go.
Note to self, don't do a podcast with someone you know personally.
But ultimately it really was a story about love and family. And so you took me to all those places, and that's me, the reader, who didn't live through it. And
hold on, I'm just getting a tissue. I'll be right back.
Fair enough. I'm going to leave my tears on the screen.
Okay, I'm here. I'm back.
Okay, me too. So I read it. And you wrote it, but you also lived through it. So did the writing of this take you to all sorts of different places, to those places, to any places that you were surprised about or confused about? Or tell me about that, or tell us about that.
Well, I do. So I wanted to write the story, or at least a small portion of the story, for a long time, basically since we knew each other. I think the first time I sat down to just try and write parts of it was when I was 17. So literally when we were interacting, but I just couldn't get much down on the page that I was happy with. And I wound up, after many tries through my 20s, I wound up just putting it away. But it was sort of aching at me that I, for some reason, felt compelled I had to write the story. But finally, it was the pandemic and my kids were a little, you know, I have two little kids and they started to be more independent. And I was just like, I think it's time for me to write the book. But I think I had already done a lot of, like, a tremendous amount of personal work and processing of my upbringing. So at the time I wrote the book, I felt that it was already sort of behind me, and I was writing it with that distance. And in many ways that's true, and maybe that's why it took me as long as it did. But also, of course, it also took me to places that I wasn't expecting. So certain chapters would just get me into a funk for a few days, or, you know, I would start weeping for some reason when I wrote something that I didn't even know I had emotional relationship with, like some of the early chapters with one of my mom's early girlfriends, that woman Sable, like Nick came home, my husband came home from work one day and he walked in and I was just pouring. And I was like, I didn't even know I still felt feelings about this woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for the most part, I wrote it from a place of distance, which I think was a benefit to the writing.
Did you, in the process, come to remember things that you had not remembered until you started writing this book? And suddenly it was like, oh yeah, then that happened. Oh, wait.
You know, it wasn't so much remembering, because there were a lot of, you know, there were different scenes I had already written throughout the years. So I would go and reference back. And so that was able to sort of take me right there, because I'd luckily been trying to write this thing for as long as I had. But I think what was interesting to me was just putting it all into context and into a stream. And then, I think just lining up timelines and understanding when things happened, even though there might be like a sense, for example, that my mom was on drugs for such a long period, but then understanding when it was in a timeline and I had concrete, you know, evidences of X, Y, and Z, being like, wow, that really was a long time. Mm. Or I don't know if that makes sense, but I sort of approached, it's odd to approach your life this way, but I did sort of approach it like an investigator trying to understand what happened. Mm.
Okay. So your mom is, plays a big role in this memoir. It's a memoir, it's your memoir, and it's a biography of your mom, and right from a yet another distance. And how was she with you writing it, both about her and her life, but also about you and your life? I mean, right, because it's so clear from the book that she, you know, she may have been imperfect, whatever that means, in many ways, but she was so clearly a mom. Whatever she had to do, she was going to look out for your best interests in whatever way she could. So she was in your corner the whole time. So it's a story about that. But I'm curious about, you know, it's pretty revelatory. It may not, I mean, she would go like, what? You're not gonna say you can't write that.
Oh yeah. Well, to start with, we have a really beautiful relationship today. And so it's a wonderful relationship today. And we've done a lot of healing and she's now sober. And so I think she's coming from a place of, but I won't lie that it was a journey to get her comfortable with me putting this out there. Mm-hmm. When I first told her that I was in earnest writing the book, even after I got a book deal, I think because I had been talking about this since I was 17 and I'm now 38, I think she thought it was like the boy who cried wolf, that this project would never see the light of day. And so she very happily participated in very in-depth, hours-long interviews. because like so many grandparents, I'm so busy with my kids. And she's like, oh, it's quality time with my daughter, who, as you say, she's very invested in. And talking about myself, which, as you know from the book, she loves to do. So I got some really rich and juicy material from recorded interviews with my mother that I think there was just some cognitive dissonance that those would then be put on the page.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet.
So she sort of was waltzing through the beginning stages of this book, like having the best time of her life. It was only at the point in which I handed her a draft, and I knew that the draft would be hard for her. So I edited out of the draft I gave her as like a starting point.
Yeah, exactly.
The harder parts that I thought she just was not going to be able to handle.
It's like somebody going into the hot tub for the first time. Okay, yeah, we're going in bathing suits. No problem. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, what surprised me is I really made it PG for her just to like get us started. And on page one, she came back with notes the whole way down and had issues with the tiniest things you could possibly imagine. At which point I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this. What's this actually be like when I show her?
Exactly.
Not, I would not redo that year of my life getting my mom comfortable with me publishing the book, because it was a lot of, I think I had the intuition in the back of my, I think I knew deep down that she would be okay at the end. For whatever reason, I believed that. So I would, but it was a long process. We had to do multiple therapy sessions. She had many psychological breakdowns. I think because part of my mom's persona, which I get into in the book, is she very much cares what people think. And there's such a different story going on behind the scenes. So for me to have decided to take that and put that out there, that was a lot. And that I think that's a conflict a lot of people who write memoir deal with, is like, how do you write about people who, especially people who are alive? I don't know if we were still in the mud, I would be able to write it, because it'd be sort of incriminating, but maybe because it's now so far in the past.
Yeah. I don't know if this was a piece of what you wanted to communicate or what you wanted to a reader to get from it, but the, you just made mention of, right. So your mom presents a story, or very much cares about presenting a story that looks this way, this particular way, and yet what's going on behind is very different. And I think that that's one of the things, certainly for me, it's not like that's an, you know, yes, of course I knew that, but I felt maybe it's because I knew you and your mom, right? I know, but I felt like the book, intentional or otherwise, did such a magnificent job of calling that out, of making that really crystal clear. Like, you have no idea. One has no idea what someone else is going through. The judgments we make about anybody, right? About like the God, what an asshole. Yeah, that may be. That person may be an asshole, but boy, we don't understand. We don't know. We can find out and then decide, yeah, that person's really just a thoroughgoing asshole. Or we might, as you did in the book, or at least what I got from it, was we might say, wow, I had no idea. Of course that's why, blah, blah, blah.
You hit the nail on the head. You just never know what someone's going through and what their private struggles are. And even your own family, like I tell a story very late in the book, and I put it intentionally late in the book, about my mother's childhood. And I hoped that would do exactly what it sounds like it did, which is sort of shake the reader into being like, wow, I didn't know everything. You know, for most of my life, I didn't know my mom's whole story. And she intended to never tell me her whole story. And it was only in hearing it on accident through a friend of hers that I was able to ultimately have a very close relationship with my mom and have compassion for her. And so that was something I wanted to explore, just how, we just never know what someone's going through in their private world. And that's sort of what's so beautiful about literature and memoirs. You know, you get to sort of live inside someone else's life. And
I will tell you, one of the most moving, this is not supposed to be happening here. One of the most moving pieces for me was right towards the very end, not the very end, but just about when you were hosting your siblings. By the way, how many are there now?
I think we're in the 40s now.
Oh my Lord. And your mom showed up with stuff, with pictures and things. And it was just like the unintended brilliance of this, like wanting to give you a life with a family and a dad. And even though she may have paid for dad to show up on this occasion or that occasion, or like the treasure in these mementos, in these pictures in this. It's almost like she was suddenly the mother of this entire family of people sort of wanting to, in one way or another, connect with this dad they never had, right? Who was their dad, sort of. It was delightful. Suddenly, like, my view of your mom, she was clearly a great mom. No, take that back. She was clearly a mom trying to be a mom for you with all of her challenges the whole time. But I wasn't a fan of her. I wasn't a big fan until the end. Mm-hmm. And that scene of her being, in some ways, everybody's mom at that moment. It was really, really moving. Really was delightful. So, and some of your siblings are actually in your life now as people that you connect with and are connected to and share things with and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. There are a few that I'm very close with, and then, you know, others, I could foresee becoming close with at some time. They're all spread out over the US. Yeah. So, you know, seeing them becomes complex, but,
how does that happen? Like literally, technically, how does that happen? So, you know, the sperm bank is in Los Angeles, or was in Los Angeles, but everybody's spread out. Did everybody start in Los Angeles, or did, you know, somebody from Indiana say, hey, I've read through your book and I want number 150.
So the California Cryobank, you know, and my mom decided she wanted to have kids this way. She was the only gay woman she knew trying to start a family. So this is, we're talking at the very earliest stages of this. Right. I think in the 90s, it right. became more commonplace. And of course, now it's way more commonplace. But so it was sort of the Wild West, and people didn't know what they were doing. And there were these, you know, the sperm, there had always been doctors who would somehow get sperm to give to an infertile couple, but creating a business around this was just beginning. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't even sell to single women or gay women. I mean, it was a whole, you know, things have changed a lot since then. Sure. Homophobia was rampant.
Yeah, that was all different. Yeah, we forget how quickly.
So my mom found my father and asked him to donate sperm, but then she took him to the California Cryobank to have him tested for STDs. And so that's how he got the idea to start doing this professionally, because he saw a lineup of men donating for money. And he was like, oh, people make money this way. This is amazing. but, you know, so, but the California Cryobank was one of the, now today it's one of the three largest sperm banks in the world. But at that time, it was one of the few that were open. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the first one that would drop ship to people's homes. So you would have it sent on dry ice all over the United States. And a staggering statistic I came across when I was writing the book is that the California Cryobank is now the sixth largest customer of FedEx in California.
Wow.
So sperm is being sent all over the country.
As we speak.
As we speak, this is a big business. And, you know, at that time, they were recruiting college students is mostly how they came across, med students often is mostly how they came across their donors. And so my dad was sort of this lark that had come in through this other way. And he was a musician, and he donated for over 10 years, three times a week, whereas some of these do it for a semester or just during college. So they had a lot of supply. He was incredibly handsome. You know, he was a Chippendales dancer.
Did people get to see him before they picked?
People didn't get to see him, but the cryobank nurses saw him. And this was a very, you know, parents are calling, who do you think I should use? Who's handsome? You know, I mean, so they had all this supply, and he's just, you know, he was the 80s ideal of what a man, you know, in television might look like.
Did he falsify? Like, did he tell an accurate story of who he was, or no?
I think that he told an accurate picture of what he put his best foot forward, as a man might if he met a girl at a bar and is trying to sleep with her. He exaggerated and played down certain things. So he called himself a classical dancer as opposed to a stripper. He said that he had a college degree, but he had done a semester at a transcendental meditation college. Right. It was unaccredited.
Right.
But he wrote true things too about his spirituality and his views on life. But he didn't mention his early schizophrenia diagnosis because he didn't believe that was true. That was a false diagnosis. I learned about that much later. But
do you know if any of your siblings are struggling with that?
I think we've had two or three that have had schizo-related diagnosis.
Because
that is a heritable trait. We have a lot of siblings who are leading really happy, fulfilling lives too. But that's really complicated when you get into, I didn't want to hit the reader over the head. To be honest, I don't have strong opinions about regulation around sperm donation. Of course, I think accurate reporting of information should be. But there are a lot of people out there that believe that, there should be limits on the number of children born or, all kinds of other things.
You had made mention of that. I'm not sure if it was in the book or in one of our conversations, but, geographical distribution.
Proximity.
You can never know, but you can never know, right? There's all sorts of things one can never know, whether it's through a sperm bank or through the bar. If somebody's donating sperm and there's 30 out there, 50 out there, 150 out there, and they're located in the same city, hold on. And you had a scare about that, right?
They might end up dating each other. I dated one of my brothers.
Exactly.
Well, that was, I think the heart of the story is sort of my untraditional nuclear family. But then it just felt like a true story about the birth of this industry and all the wild ramifications, because there are so many. And it just makes you... I just think that's an interesting point in history to document.
So tell me about your dad over the years. Were you always, so as a little girl, you were clearly excited when dad was coming. What was that? When I knew you in high school, was your dad in the picture?
He
was 17.
At that time, he had come back into the picture. So he was very in the picture when I was young.
Yes.
Then he got into heavy drugs, probably a little bit around the time my mom started getting into them. But my mother decided that she didn't want to have him around, that it probably wasn't healthy. There were a couple incidents that I document in the book where it just became clear that things were going downhill, possibly like a meth or speed addiction, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Weird friends and companions. Whether he decided to come out of my life or she decided, some of that is back and forth between them. But there were many years when I didn't see much of him. And then those later high school years, he came back in. But at that point, his mind had turned a little bit. So things were just, and I think I was hurt by the fact he had disappeared. So I was just, I was a teenager and I just wanted nothing to do with him. So he would come over and my mom would be like, Krista, time to spend time with your dad. And he'd be like, he was just off the rocker. He once came over and threw a Playgirl at me and I opened it not knowing what it was. And there's my father.
Thanks, Dad.
Naked. Yeah. And it's, so these kinds of interactions.
I'll never be able
helping our relationship.
I'll never be able to not see that, Dad.
But he was always, so I just didn't have much of a relationship. And then I think after I understood the sperm donation and all of that, I was like, just understanding the scope of the story that my mother had asked him, that he hadn't willingly become my dad. understanding that there had been a financial transaction, or I guess willingly is the wrong word, but that understanding how much my mom had pulled the strings of that relationship was just complicated for me. So she had paid him to have me, but then something I didn't realize until way later was that she had paid him to then be around. And I think sometimes it was as transactional as like, you come for a birthday party and I give you $100. So I think that there was always this open question in my mind of like, did my father genuinely care about me? Or was I just...
What's the answer to that question?
Right
now to 38-year-old Krista, did your dad genuinely care about you?
I think the answer is maybe to the best of his ability. I don't know that he's capable of caring for anyone in the way that I would imagine an ideal relationship with a dad. Mm-hmm. I think he just has, and so I just feel sad for him that that is the case. And I sort of accept him as he is, and try to be loving, but also not to let it suck me in too much, because I worry about him too. And yeah.
Yeah. So there's still, I mean, there is, that's one of the things I think that's so, that's that through line through the book that sort of, at least for me, culminates at the, towards the end is that, you know, he's a dad. There's this way in which there is whatever counts as love, there whatever counts as care, it's somehow there. And in whatever way he could, whatever that meant, even though it was this transaction, it's such a mixed up mind blow. I don't need to tell
you. Oh my God, no, it is. Well, because my mother, you know, made it so cemented it that this is dad. It was never, this is sperm donor. This is dad.
Yes.
You can't unwind that psychologically. So for me, the relationship is so much more complicated than for any of the biological siblings who are just like, oh, this is my quirky sperm donor.
Exactly.
I bear no responsibility for what happens to him in his life. But like, for better or worse, it's my dad. So it's complicated.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Because my mother orchestrated it that way.
You bet. Yeah. And so where is he now? You had said he was on his way in the book. He was on his way to India, but then he, last time we spoke, he had not yet been there.
Yeah. So in the course of the book, I sort of follow him as being this bohemian hippie model musician, sleeping on girlfriends' couches, and then eventually becoming, no longer having a home and sleeping on the street, et cetera, or in his car, or eventually in a motorhome. So things got really bleak. And then at the end of the book, he inherits money from his mother.
From his mom. Yeah.
Yeah. And goes to India, which was like, he'd always said, I'm on my way to India next week, which is why I can't do X, Y, Z, get a job, move into a home, do any, you know. He was always on his way to India. So another boy.
See, he knew it was coming.
He knew he was going eventually. So he got this inheritance from his mother. It was a sizable inheritance. And he went to India. And now, a few years later, that is gone. He came back.
You mean the money or India?
Both.
India is there. I know India is there.
No, the money, I'm not... It's not clear to me how it went so quickly. He was not open to ideas for how that could be stretched. And then he came back and he was unhoused, living in his car for a while. But he's stubborn too. Like he won't, you know, when you try and help, it's like, it's hard to have it not just take over your life because he doesn't want the help in the way that it could actually be helpful. He's very complicated and stubborn. And so I wound up just help. He decided he wanted to go back to India after a couple of years like this. And so I helped him get over there. And now he's rescuing dogs in India.
He is in India. He went, yeah. He ultimately did go back.
He went back. Wow. I think culturally he likes, you know, he fits in more with that culture. And
do you have a relationship with your dad? Do you have a relationship with your dad?
My relationship with my dad you know, we send each other like birthday and holiday messages. He sends me pictures of the animals that he's in the middle of rescuing. And then I expect that I will probably ultimately be financially responsible for him. Mm-hmm. And I try to just be loving, and I'm trying to, I think navigating where the boundaries will be is something that is an ever going process.
Yeah.
If there was any chance that he would possibly listen to this podcast, I might edit that. But since there's no chance whatsoever, I feel like.
Well, I will say that that's another place it took me through too, was that the importance of the weirdness of love, right? I mean, love sort of springs from the most peculiar places. Like towards the end of the book, I didn't give a shit that he got paid for to come to the birthday party. It was like, whereas when I first read it, it was like, what a fucking asshole. Like, what? You did like, what kind of a person would say, oh yeah, that's how I'm going to see my, and you know, was it just part of your mom's charade or your mom's sort of orchestrated thing? And by the end of it, it was like, well, you know, hey, people do things for all sorts of reasons. So, okay. This one was just, you know, more easy to see. I understand why you're doing that. But, you know, there he is sitting on the beach with two little girls and their mom. Can we shift a little bit? Unless you're getting tired and you're going to tell me I have to get off. But can we shift a little bit to conversations about you?
Please. I want to know when you were angry at me.
Well, yeah. Do you think so? Do you have a story about how it is that you came to struggle with issues of anxiety, issues of depression, issues of addiction, in whatever form, whether it's to a person, my least favorite person in the book, James, or a behavior, or a, you know, non-behavior, eating challenges, anxiety. Do you have a story about where that comes from? Where that, you think, like, is it your upbringing that presented these challenges to you, that put you in that in those struggles, and do you have feelings about that, or do you know, God knows, it's serendipity. Anybody could have experiences that land them there. I want to know about, it's not in your book, I want to know about where you think all that's from.
I think I'm interested in, you know, generational trauma in general as a concept, and cycles of dysfunction and where they originate and how they, you know, so much, it seems, in my mother's line, started with her father's experience in war and how that sort of like trickled down through generations. And so that was interesting to me. And
did you ever meet? Did you ever? You didn't. You
didn't. No, I didn't meet either of my grandparents.
Yeah.
And so part of what I wanted to show in the book, when I start to display, I mean, I'm talking about me as a character, even though it's me. Yeah. But when I started to display, you know, I sort of wanted to show the reader how this organically happens, because you know, I get into this horrible, toxic, abusive relationship with a boy, and then I get an eating disorder. And then, yeah, I have all these, as you say, anxiety, depression. I start to see the beginnings of addiction. And, but I think in the context of the book, you sort of understand how I get there a little bit. And I think so many people, you know, when you're living in a family unit or however you grow up, and it's completely dysfunctional, it's also all you know. And so you're not presented really with other options for how it could be. I think you just think that the world is that way. And you, so I was sort of just interested in how those patterns develop and how, if it's possible to break them. And I think another benefit of me having written the now versus before is like, I really did heal. Like I have a beautiful life now. Mm-hmm. We quirky and eccentric, but I'd be happy to open it, you know, open the doors to anyone to come in.
I think that's what home life means. That's a translation of home life is quirky.
And I've really like struggle, you know, I'm past a lot of that. And so I think part of what I wanted to do in the book for a certain subset of readers, which is, I think, a lot of people that are attracted to memoir of this genre, is sort of be, you know, maybe give some hope that you can get out of it, and it can get really dark, and you can change, and you can, you know, have a different future. And
it's clear that you're, well, clear that you climb, you've climbed out of it. It also is clear to me that 17, 18 year old Krista had, you may not remember this, but way more insight into, you spoke about, like, for instance, with this character, this toxic relationship with James. You knew that then. You knew it was toxic. You spoke to me about it, right? Mm. You knew it was toxic. You knew you couldn't. You knew it was not. It didn't just fit easily into the category of teenage crush, right? Yeah. You knew there was something, for lack of a better term, pathological, but dark about it.
It was completely pathological. Yeah. To be clear. Yeah.
And there was a way in which you know the ins and outs of it much more so now, but you knew, you were aware, didn't just.
That's true. So maybe, you know, a lucky gift is that I've always had self-awareness, but as you said, addiction, like it was an addiction. So even if I understood that it was unhealthy, that was way overrided by my addiction to this person. Yeah. I think it was the same for my eating disorder, even though I knew, you know, throwing up in the toilet, everything that I ate and fitting into pants that I had worn when I was 11 was problematic. There was also a flip side of me that couldn't stop. And in my deranged mind thought that that was more beautiful or so I think there definitely is, maybe there are levels, like you're in a good spot if you're in a bad place, but you have the self-awareness that it's unhealthy because eventually your desire to live a healthy life can.
Was your mom not, did she not see those? Well, no, that's not fair. She knew that your relationship was terrible and tried to keep him away and all that. And you definitely speak about that. Were you handling most of this on your own?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think is a common trait of kids who grow up in homes with addiction, is you, for better or worse, become very independent and private and isolated. Mm-hmm. But my mom also had with my husband now, he's so normal in so many ways. And I think it's very hard for my mother to like wrap her head around. Like, she knows what to do with a crazy person. Like, that's home for her. Like, that is normal. So, you know, she might on the one hand be getting going to the police station to get a restraining order on this person, but the next morning she might be serving us breakfast in bed with a flower. Like, and thinking, oh, poor guy, he just needs a little mom love. You know, you can't have a sick person helping another sick person get well.
Yeah, it doesn't work out so well. Oh, wow. So tell me about your sister and how all this, you know, in as comfortable a way as much as you can, that you feel like, you know, it's yours to tell.
Well, I did strip. If anyone was stripped back a little, it was Kate in the book, just because I was like, oh, that's her own private. I felt like my dad's never going to read this and he's fine with it. He weirdly loves all of the attention. And
He also loves animals, and that's a lot of plus. So
yeah, totally. And I could get my mom comfortable with it, but I felt like, yeah, Kate, I just like give her some privacy. But I think in some ways it impacted us in similar ways and in some ways different.
Do you know if she, reading the memoir, sort of had insights, not necessarily to you, but to herself, but insights about that, that helped her sort through some things? Or
I don't know about that. I think that there, maybe for both of us, there was a sense, I can't speak for her, but like, when you've lived so much of your life in shame and trying to pretend that things are more normal seeming than they are, there's a lot of work that goes into that and a lot of emotional baggage. And I think sort of just having it out there is a relief, because yeah, it's just like, yeah, this is what mm-hmm. happened. And yeah, it was really nuts.
Yeah,
but
you don't have to keep covering up.
Yeah, but the fun thing about, so Caitlin read it a few times, and she's really funny, Caitlin. So she was a huge help, because she'd be like, you're completely missing the humor of what was happening in that moment. Yes, it was really dark and depressing, but you forgot to mention, you know, that mom wanted to put a hippopotamus in the swimming pool, or, you know, that she was gonna, you know, she just had so many colorful anecdotes that I think lent a tremendous amount of humor to the book. So mm-hmm. that doesn't answer your question exactly. But
but it sort of does. But it sort of,
I mean,
does.
I think that the fun thing is, like, with a true story, everyone still has a different perspective. And you might, you know, David, Brian, go into your household, and each of you could talk about your childhood and have like a, you know, the same thing occurred, but you see it all differently.
Completely. And, yes.
So
that's happened many times. Just so you know. It's like I have a brother who is a year older, almost exactly a year older. We had the same parents, slept in the same room for many years, went to the same schools, had many of the same teachers. What the fuck is he talking about?
Yeah. So every family has that. So I did try my best to present other points of view when they differed from mine, or, yeah, you know, and I think that made it a richer story.
Mm-hmm.
So Caitlin's were included in that. And yeah. She's very, but you know, we're different. Like, I think what, like, psychologically what I needed was to, like, I needed to have my own family and find a super stable husband and, like, you know, set up shop, like a home, and like that was very important for me as like a repairing, whereas I think she's just a little bit more free-spirited and like still figuring out what she wants life to look like. And so I don't know if there's like an older sibling, younger sibling, like I'm more anal. you know, she's a little bit more easygoing, so we just have, you know, we're different.
Yeah
as are all siblings, I think.
As are all
biological and
even those that are biologically similar. Yeah, exactly. You know, you've got a very, you just said it, a delightful, wonderful, normal family. Does that family include all the other, you've got a dad, you've got a mom. Now your mom, your relationship with your mom is wonderful now.
Not without its complications. She drives me insane.
No, of course. Yeah. She's mom, right?
But I mean, it's more innocent.
That's their job. Well, everybody's doing their job. But when they go, how's your family?
I think of all of it. Yeah, of course.
Cool.
I think of it in maybe rings.
Yeah.
But so it's like the core, and then it spreads
out. It's a good title. It's the normal family. It is a normal family. It's just a unique normal family.
Yes.
Very. That's what's so, that was what was so delightful. Oh, God. So I really loved it.
Well, I hope that there are a lot of universal feelings and themes, even if it's a specific story. Yeah.
Are there things that you wish you'd left out? Things that you wish you had included? The writing part here.
I don't think so. No, I'm really proud of it. I think, you know, it definitely should be. I trimmed a lot. A lot was left out. I feel like I wrote the book I set out to write.
That's so good.
Yeah.
That's so good. Was it hard?
Hard to write it?
Yeah. Do things just so flow immediately from your pen?
Or, no. Yeah. No, not at all. It was a lot got thrown out. A lot of tremendous amount of writing got thrown out. You have to make choices. There was a point at which I told a lot more of my father's backstory. And then I just realized it was just too much. I felt like I could do that with my mom, but then a repeat with my dad, it was just, there was a lot of reorganizing. There was a point at which I started the book with my mother's childhood, but I think where I put it was more effective emotionally.
Absolutely.
No, it was a complete struggle. And I'm just so glad it's behind me.
That's so nice to hear.
Yeah. I don't know. I was writing your book. Was that easy?
You know, I mean, seven drafts. And it's at some point it was just like, okay, that's it. I'm done. I don't care. I mean, I stopped caring. It was so painful to keep again and again. And then, you know, it's over. And then I was like, oh God, I should have talked about that and this and that, blah, 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 blah. And so.
You can write another one.
Well, I'm thinking about it. That was my last question for you. So what's the next one?
I don't know. You know, that was like the burning thing I had to put out there. You know, recently there was a comical and absurd incident that happened with my mother. I'm like, oh, that would make a great New Yorker essay. Like, you know, you know, maybe some short form sort of David Sedaris inspired family stories would be fun. I don't know that I'm setting out to write another book anytime soon. That's a real endeavor. Yeah. I think you have to be sort of like taken over by the need to do it. To really get it done, because it takes so much. Yeah. But
There are people for whom that's not true. And I'm so...
I know.
They both anger me and I envy them. Like, <It's> really?
Oh, that was a piece of cake. I could do it 10 like, times.
And there's just another one and it's good. You know, really? Yeah, but... Well, Krista Bilden, you have anything else that you want to say about it?
No, I hope this was valuable in some way to you.
It's both valuable and delightful, and as was your book.
And you can correct the record about New Roads in the paperback.
If you
like something I said.
No. Don't take that in. Do not take it.
I do have to say that you were a tremendous, tremendous principal, and what a gift that was in my life at that time, and probably so many other kids.
Well, thank you for saying that, and I appreciate that. And
you're the only class, I mean, in all of my schooling, including college, I think the lessons that you taught in your, I don't know if it was mysteries or what it was, but those have stayed with me. And I still remember them crisply. And I mean, how many, you know, kids just sort of sit through class, but I remember a lot of those like ethical.
Oh, that was that. That's right. Society and ethics, probably. I don't know. Well,
so. You should be
and you know, I remember, I think this is true. I remember every student, but there are some students that hold a special place. And you are definitely in that category. You might as well tell Caitlin, as is.
Yeah,
it's,
very.
It's really so it's so, there we go.
There we go again.
It's so
note to self, don't do a podcast with someone you know.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.